And is a research meteorologist at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography at UC San Diego, and is also a researcher at the USGS. And since 1996, he has served as director of the Scripps Institute Climate Research Division. His work is aimed at understanding climate variability and changes, particularly as they apply to the Pacific Ocean and North America. His specific work concerns impacts of climate changes on water resources and other sectors in Western North America. He also works on large-scale exchange of heat and water between the ocean and the atmosphere. Dan is also a director of the California Climate Change Center, a center which works to improve climate information and forecasts for decision makers in the California region. And I'm sure it's information we can take throughout the United States. Dan received a Bachelor of Science degree in meteorology and oceanography. You can see I even have a hard time saying them. He received them in 1971 from University of Michigan, which makes us about the same age, Dan. But I'm just a poor, broken-down lawyer and economist. He received a Ph.D. in oceanography in 1990 from the University of California, San Diego. Dan's presentation today will focus on climate change and how it is a looming challenge to our water supply. Please welcome Dr. Kane.
Thank you, Susan. Well, it's a privilege to be here. I'm really impressed with the gathering that you've all assembled here and the quality of the discussion. I know that I don't want to wear out my welcome, so I'll try to get through this in sort of on time. At one time there was a pointer up here and it seems to have disappeared. So maybe we can just go on to the next slide and in the meantime we'll find the pointer. It wasn't very many years ago, or actually not that many audiences ago, that I sort of felt like I was in a slightly different environment than the one that I've heard this morning. The way I'm going to structure this talk is to... thank you. Okay. All right. Is to talk about mainly observations first and then models and observations second and then kind of sum up. So next one. If you look at the traces on this plot, which is a global average version of the surface temperature of the Earth, the thick dark line in this trace is actually the observed, or what we estimate to be the observed temperature of the Earth's surface. And the other part, the colored parts of the plot, are actually modeled, these GCMs, global climate models or general circulation model, versions of the surface temperature. The first thing that I would point out is that if you look up to the middle part of the 1900s, what you see is that the models replicate observations pretty well. And now what I should say about this is there's two versions of the model that are being run here, and this is the beauty of having models, is that we can run them with, in this case, greenhouse gas forcing included or excluded. And the The blue envelope is the set of model runs that was done without greenhouse gases, and the red envelope is the one with. So the message here is that up until about 1970, the two families follow each other pretty closely, but then they start to diverge. And the reason they diverge, of course, is that greenhouse warming is becoming a stronger influence, and the actual Earth's climate is starting to feel that and depart from what it would look like if, I can't get the pointer to work, but if the if we only had natural variability, which you can see that by the end of the 20th century, the difference between modeled with natural variability and the actual observations or modeled with greenhouse gas forcing is about a half a degree Celsius or about a degree Fahrenheit different. So we've seen what we think we can attribute to anthropogenic forcings, a change, a warming, averaged over the Earth of about a degree Fahrenheit. Now, I would assert that it does matter whether it's human or not. And the reason it does matter is that because if it is, then we can anticipate that this is going to continue. In other words, having an understanding of the causality of climate is imperative for your business because it lets you plan. And if you believe us guys, the climate guys, then what we're going to see is going to amplify this divergence. Oh, thank you. Okay, so next one. Now, in the West, as you've already heard, you heard a really interesting session just an hour or so ago on the mountainous watershed issue. And, of course, one of the principal differences there is that snow lines become, compared to present day or the climatology that the water community has traditionally based decisions on, snow lines are going to be higher, and they raise at about half a kilometer or so per degree Celsius. Take that, let's see, 6 degrees C per kilometer, so you can do the conversion. I don't want to try to do this on the podium. I'll get it wrong. But that has two effects, of course. It has the effect of reducing the natural reservoir of snow that we can we would normally use in spring and summer, and it liberates more water immediately. That's the flood problem that you heard the director of the California Water Resources talking about. Next one. And We saw the global average picture, but this is what's happened in the western part of North America since about World War II. We've seen that this large area, this happens to be a time-averaged March, April, May. That's our classical springtime in climate parlance. This red shading means that we've warmed relative to a longer-term average by something like a degree Celsius to as much as 2 or 3 degrees Celsius in central western Canada. So we have seen quite a warming over the period of our professional lifetimes. Let's go to the next one. And furthermore, if you simply play a sort of a thought experiment, which my colleague Mike Dettinger has done here for the landscape of the United States, and he's simply taken a census of precipitation day by day every event that's occurred over a long period, and he's cataloged how many of those events have occurred where temperatures were within the range of minus 3 degrees Celsius, just below freezing, and freezing. And what's shaded on here, the scale is at the bottom, is just the fraction of time for a given location in which the precipitation has occurred within that temperature range. That is a range of what we might call vulnerability, because if temperature rises by 3 degrees Celsius, all of a sudden we're not snowing anymore, we're raining. So you can think of this as a flood vulnerability map. You can think of this as a potential vulnerability of the loss of snow storage. It's the western problem, as you can see, and particularly areas like the west slope of the Sierras and the Cascades, parts of the Rocky Mountains are especially vulnerable to warming. So we in California have a huge stake in this sort of turn of this kind of vulnerability to warming. You can see there's some of it in the Northeast, but not to the degree that we have here. Next one. We've already seen over the West, Maury Roos is sitting in the audience, I think. Maury, are you? Yeah, there's Maury. State hydrologist, a living encyclopedia of California water. Maury had looked at the record of the fraction of runoff that occurs between April and July, our traditional snowmelt period in California. You can pretty much attribute the volume of runoff from the Sacramento system, which is, that's what's mapped here, occurring between April and July is being attributed to runoff, and that has declined from what used to be, I'm having trouble reading my own slide here, but I'm thinking that that's 40% to 30%, but maybe it was 50 to 40. But we've lost a significant fraction of that that spring-summer snowmelt runoff. And when viewed across the western landscape, that's the lower map picture here on the left, where the red dots represent earlier timing of snowmelt basin flows, and the blue ones mean later. Earlier, of course, means that spring is coming earlier, things are warming up. We see a very broad footprint of earlier flows, something of the timing of a week to, in some cases, 3 weeks, averaged across the whole network, probably about a week earlier in this period since 1948. Next one, please. Colleagues at the University of Washington, Phil Molt and colleagues have looked at snow courses across the West and looked at the April 1 measurement from snow courses and reckoned that there's been a trend in the April 1 water content, which red here is a trend towards lower amounts, blue higher. You can see that most all of the elevations, except for the really high elevations in California and some of the southern Rockies, have lost snow on April 1st. About 75% of the snow courses are showing this decline. Next one. And when you map out these declines, this is plotted. The trend is plotted across the bottom from negative to the left and positive to the right, and elevation is traced on the vertical scale here. So lower is down and higher is up. Lower is warmer, higher is cooler. You can see that the losses, the larger losses, of course, are occurring at lower to middle elevations in our western catchments. And, of course, that makes sense. Those are the areas which are closer to the freezing level. Next one. Noah Knowles, who's sitting back here in the audience, has conducted a study of precipitation gauges across the West, where, first of all, climatologically, these gauges have been ones that have received snow, and they have a fairly substantial record. And also, they've recorded snowfall. That is, they have either a snowboard or some other ability to measure daily snow accumulation. And over the about the same period as we looked at in the stream gauge network, he's showing the ones that have lost and the ones that have gained in their fraction of precipitation that is snow. And as you can see, the large majority, again, about 75% of these weather stations are receiving more rain, less snow over this period. So we are seeing rivers flowing earlier. That is, the melting season is coming earlier. We're also seeing storms which are delivering more rain and less snow. In other words, the storms themselves are warmer. It's not just the interstorm periods which are warmer. So our climate of our generation is warmer than our moms and dads and our grandparents. Next one. So let's consider what the climate models have to say about all this. Next one. First of all, just to remind you about the greenhouse effect. So here we have two planetary bodies. We have the moon and the Earth. Of course, the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. It doesn't have quite enough gravity to retain an atmosphere. So it doesn't have a greenhouse effect. It doesn't have these heat-trapping gases like CO2 and methane and so forth, which are the reason that global warming is happening. The moon has an average temperature that's about 33 Celsius less than Earth on average. So the greenhouse effect is a natural phenomena. The greenhouse effect that you're used to hearing about on the news by President Bush and all those other experts is the incremental effect of us adding, so far we've added about a third to the pre-industrial level of CO2 in the atmosphere as well as several of the other greenhouse gases. But if you want to question the viability of the physics, here's a great example. Let's go to the next one. Now, this is looking forward. These are these so-called emission scenarios. You've heard the word or the acronym IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is going to announce the first of its reports for the fourth global assessment that's coming out this winter and spring. And in order to conduct those experiments, they have to make some assumptions about the future, what sort of loading of the atmosphere we're going to see in terms of greenhouse gases. And here's a swarm of different scenarios, which, of course, depend on economics, sort of geopolitical relationships, regulations, technology, and so forth. The environmentally friendly scenario that you might look at is this green one down here. And the more carbon-intensive fossil fuel economies are these. This is not the CO2 content in the atmosphere. This is the flux of CO2 into the atmosphere. So this scenario would have the emissions increasing to about the middle part of the century, and then for a variety of reasons, probably the variety resembles the variety of reasons that people are talking about in managing their water supply portfolio. We also have a carbon supply portfolio to the atmosphere. So there's been a number of climate experiments, and they, to a large extent, hinge on these scenarios of what's being loaded into the atmosphere. So that's lying behind what you see. And in the recent California assessment, we used three of these scenarios, or at least models that were based on those, to guide us in assessing what might happen in the state of California in sort of a broad base of different impacts, ranging from water resources to forests, human health, beaches, coasts, agriculture, and so on. So let's go on to the next one. Okay, this is kind of one of those tricky PowerPoint graphs, and this is where I pretend I'm Al Gore. So now we're taking the longer point of view, and these three traces here, at the bottom is global temperature, the surface temperature of the Earth, made out from proxy records of temperatures. Of course, we didn't have thermometers beyond 150 years ago, so this has all been reconstructed from sediments and ice and so forth, isotopes that are contained in these proxies. And at the top is CO2, which when you look at them, they're pretty well correlated. So this is in hundreds of thousands of years, and it's interesting that you see this pretty remarkable, at least from a climate perspective, pretty remarkable cyclicity in global temperatures. Of course, the high excursions here are the so-called interglacials. We're living in one now. That's why we're sitting here in San Francisco and comfortable. But, you know, other periods of Earth history, we would have been, you know, huddled in a cave or something. One of the primary factors in causing this periodicity or rough periodicity is the fact that there are orbital properties of the solar system and the planets that revolve around them. In this case, the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit that changes the radiative budget of the Earth. And, that goes, this eccentricity has about a 100,000-year period, and lo and behold, there was a guy named Milankovitch that was able to kind of reproduce temperature records going back. So that's an old story, well-known, and so forth. Now let's go to the next one slowly. Okay, and you can see that the temperatures tend to rise fast, and then they sort of gradually decline when you look at these geological timescales. Next one. And you see that, interestingly, CO2 tends to follow temperature. So when the Earth gets warmer, the CO2 in the atmosphere increases because more plants, more productivity, more liberation of CO2 that's stored. But notice the vertical axis here. This to this point doesn't include the industrialization period, and the CO2 never gets above about 300 parts per million. Next one. Oops. Well, go back. Unfortunately, we missed the climax here. I was afraid this was going to happen. That's why I'm not Al Gore, because I don't have a production staff. But what's happened now is that CO2 has increased to about 380 parts per million, and in those scenarios that I showed you of the CO2 flux, if we're lucky, the CO2 at the end of the century becomes about 550 parts per million. It doubles the pre-industrial level. And if we're unlucky, or at least our kids or their kids are unlucky, it becomes over 900 parts per million. It more than triples. So that's what we're talking about in terms of the concentration of greenhouse gases. Okay, so let's go to the next one. Now, here's a whole bunch of model runs from the IPCC exercise. So imagine that there's a big community nationally and internationally of climate modeling groups that are running different of these scenarios, different climate models, somewhat different physics and so forth, and we line them all up so that at the top here we're just looking at one spot or one grid, one pixel over Northern California. And the models are run not only forward in time, but also retrospectively. They're run backward, just like I showed you before. They can replicate to some extent what we've seen, and that's one of the tests of climate models. And what we see is that, without a doubt, every climate model is warming. This is the zero line here is today's climate. So we've taken the actual temperature out of it. So we're just going to call that zero. This is just the departure from today's levels. And this is 2100. So we can see here are those numbers which you heard earlier in the day, that you see rises of temperature from about 2 degrees Celsius to more than 7 for California. This is the annually average temperature. Precipitation is done in the same fashion down here. My colleague Mike calls these spaghetti diagrams for obvious reasons. And again, this is sort of the climatology. This is what we would call today's climate back here. And you can see the swarm of different model solutions, but you don't see a consensus too much in these solutions about precipitation. But what is kind of deceiving about this is that your eye is drawn to these outliers here that go up, and it's probably not seeing the fact that there's a actually disquieting number of simulations that have gone down a little bit by 10% or so. So if you twisted my arm and you asked me what's more likely for California, wetter or drier in the future, first of all, I would say that our precipitation is going to be characterized to a large extent by variability, just like we've always seen. We've become accustomed to really wet periods, 1978 through 1986, and really dry periods, 1987 through 1994. And, you know, sometimes we actually get a normal year, but it seems like that doesn't happen too often. But in these model runs, there's this subtle tendency for a little drier. So that's, I wouldn't be too sanguine about calling for more wetness, because not too many of the model solutions are doing that. Next one. And this is why I think there's some credibility about this. This is a little hard to see, but this is a funny global projection where the map is just kind of a, you know, you just roll it out and it becomes a rectangle instead of, you know, having, anyway, the higher latitudes got the advantage in this one because they got stretched out. But here's the equator, 30 degrees north and 60 degrees north. So North America is here and here. And let's just talk about the bottom part of this, where this is the median of the projected change in precipitation, where the change is coded by color. Red is less. What did you give me there, David? Zero? Okay. Well, let's rearrange our estimate. I want to talk a little longer since everybody's giving me rapt attention here. I just want to get through this, and I'll promise to hasten up a little bit. Red is drier, and blue is wetter. And what you can see here is that along the subtropics, the latitudes between about 20 degrees north and south and 30 degrees or so, there tends to be a drying. So the way the atmosphere works when you look at it kind of sideways from along the equator is the air is rising at the equator and sinking poleward of that in the subtropics. And where it's sinking in our neck of the woods is called the North Pacific High. It's this big anticyclone. That's the reason why we don't get much rain in California, and Maureen complains about 8 inches a year, is that we're under the influence of the North Pacific High. And what's happening in these climate simulations is that those subtropical highs, more or less, are strengthening. And on the other hand, if you live in Seattle, you might be a little more encouraged because it looks like there's a tendency for latitudes from about 40 to 5 or 50 degrees north to get a bit wetter. And that wetness goes farther north. Next one. Well, Noel Noel's on the job again, has taken the warming scenario, in this case just one scenario. All he's done is he's imposed the warming on a hydrologic model. This is the domain of the watershed that drains through the Bay Delta region. So this is the Sierra Nevada here. And this is color-coded. So this is the fraction of today's snowpack on April 1st in the period surrounding 2030, the period surrounding 2060, and that around 2090. And you can see that we're eroding the lower elevations of snow. And by the time we reach 2090, in this case, warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius, we lose about 50% of the California snowpack. Didn't lose water. We just lost. It's not in the snow. Next one. That changes the hydrograph, as you heard this morning. So this is October through September. This is the aggregated Sierra runoff. More in the winter period, less in the spring and summer by a fair bit. Next one. And, of course, that means perhaps more floods. This is a recent flood, not a big one, but in May of 2005, maybe some of you remember this event, it was raining up to above 9,000 feet in Yosemite Park. This is Yosemite Valley here, these little photographs. This is the storm that did it, a very warm, moist system. We had the valley flooded out of a rainfall event that was on average across the basin just 1 inch. That's not a lot of rain. That's not a lot of rain. But it was raining up to 9,000 feet and above. Frank Gerke back there has a bunch of snow collectors up there, and his snow sensors were, you know, the rain was just going through, and to some extent it was melting a little bit. But largely the story was we were just getting more runoff immediately, and we got this sort of a minor flood. But you can imagine if this was instead of a May system, what if it was a February system where we had, instead of 2 days of precipitation, we had something like 1986 or the 1997 flood where, you know, we had hot, very high snow levels and so forth. That's what we're very concerned about. And, of course, that feeds into the levee problem in California. Next. And, of course, the Bay Delta is an estuary. Next one, please. And this was – so there was talk about sea level rise, and I heard a couple of orders of magnitude of estimates this morning. One of them was more like this, where – this is the sort of more conservative IPCC kind of estimate where the change in sea level, you already were told that sea levels along our coast are rising by about half a foot over the last century. We can expect a rise of that at least, probably, but we could see an accelerated rise of maybe 3 or 4 times that, according to IPCC. So instead of half a foot, we could see 3 feet, out here at Fort Point in San Francisco. Now, the reason there's so much uncertainty with sea level rise is, first of all, we don't know what the climate is going to do. But secondly, the way that ice gets dumped into the ocean from land-based ice, that's the way that sea level sea level rises because of 2 factors, essentially. One is the water gets warmer and it inflates because its density is less. That's pretty well understood, and that's well handled by climate models. What's not well handled is the fact that when ice gets shed from Greenland and Antarctica, those are the 2 large ice masses, there's 70 meters of excess sea level sitting in Greenland and Antarctica that could, if it was all melted, would raise sea level. But the problem is that it's not like an ice cube where we're shining a heat lamp on it and we just watch it drip into the ocean. It might slip. And what we're seeing more and more of is these failures. We saw part of Antarctica in the West Antarctic area just shed off recently in the matter of just a few days. Somebody was looking at satellite maps and away it went. And that causes sea level to rise. So that mechanism is not well understood. It's not well represented in models. Next one. The other thing that was pointed out is sea level rise by itself, this gentle 3 feet of rise, may not do too much, but when it's coupled with high tides and big storms and maybe an El Nino, which further amplifies sea levels along our coast by the tune of maybe 20 centimeters, maybe, close to a foot, do things like this. This is 1983 down in the San Diego area. Okay. And, let's go on to the next one. That shows the actual sea level record at Scripps Pier. In the Bay Delta, it's not just sea level rise. It's the fact that we have freshwater floods. This is the record of water level at the I Street water gauge in Sacramento. And those are tides. That's mostly a summer period, but these are floods. So you can see, the water levels get up to 9 meters there. There's a book called Conquering the Inland Sea, which is a history of levying the Sacramento Valley and trying to contain the water. And the fact is that this sort of thing could potentially get much more frequent and potentially potentially higher. I don't want to sound like the National Enquirer here. Okay. And when you count, you take one of these climate models and you simply look at exceedances. This is an open coast. And now this is we've taken an hourly record and we just counted the number of times in our simulation where we've included tides and weather and El Ninos and a fairly moderate amount of climate change. This case is 30 centimeters over the 100-year period. So not 3 feet, about a little more than 1 feet. But these are exceedances above a level that happens less than once a year. And you can see over time how often those get exceeded. I won't go into the filigree here. Let's go to the next one. So, you missed my cartoon. But summing up, In this report, and by the way, Guido Franco, the program manager from the climate program from the Energy Commission, and I have to say that the state of California is just a wonderful place to work because, we have this rich area, and we actually have a rich scientific community, and we actually have state agencies that are pretty enlightened, and this here meeting ain't happening in Nebraska, guys. So anyway, California has the opportunity here to really be a leader in a lot of different ways. Do we have anybody from Nebraska? Anyway, I'm sorry. The magnitude of the impacts of climate change, you know, going back to these different emission scenarios, get much worse if the global greenhouse loading takes this higher rather than lower route. And the greenhouse loading in the atmosphere, which I should have said earlier, is a big problem. Not only because of its physics, but because of its longevity. CO2 has a lifetime in the atmosphere of more than 100 years. So, you know, what we do is compounding in the atmosphere. And that's why, the analogy was this big barge. That's why we can't change things rapidly. It doesn't rain out. It's there for generations. So next one. It's already happening. There's no doubt in the climate community's mind. The precipitation, of course, is an enormous issue for you guys, but I don't think you're ever going to see with a big degree of confidence a projection you can believe. You're going to have to live as you always have. The water community is really, really adept at living with uncertainty, and this is part of it. And that's going to happen. But you can count on the fact that it's going to get warmer, sea levels are going to get higher. Let's go to the next. And you can count on the fact that a lot of these things are going to be exacerbated when there's weather events that pile up synergistically that make big storms and the like. So that's where I think I'll stop. Thanks.
Dan, will you take a couple questions?
If there
is anybody, yeah, have any questions for Dan? Okay.
Dan, can you talk a little bit about? We heard from Seattle that they, as I understood what they did, they kind of went down to sort of some regional type models.
Yeah.
What's the status of that? Some of us who have regional systems that either are at the coastal range or interior, not just snowpack for our local supplies. When can we expect some possible help from modeling that?
Right now. It exists. It's been used. That's what we used in this California assessment. We have, for these scenarios we looked at, they were all downscaled to 12 kilometers covering California and Nevada. It's not totally adequate. I'm not saying this is a solved problem. The premium grape growers want to know what's happening in Napa Valley, and right now we don't have a good answer for them because our models don't handle some of these subtleties. But for a lot of the water-related problems, I think we're okay.
CO2, long-term climate impact if
that's a great question.
CO2 response.
Yeah, hopefully we get onto that green emissions trajectory, which would have CO2 emissions leveling off by mid-century and then declining. And of course, there's a lot of inertia in the system. You know, we all have our cars. You know, you can't change power plants overnight, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, the Earth's response to climate is not going to make too much difference until about the middle part of the century between all those scenarios. So through 2050, a climate model is sort of a climate model no matter what you do with it. In fact, if you stop all CO2 emissions today, excess fossil fuel emissions, you know, the fossil fuel is the reason that it's increasing, because fossil means that it was stored in the ground and all of a sudden, you know, we're burning it and we're putting it in the atmosphere. It's not the CO2 that is just recycled by the ecosystems and so forth. If we stopped everything today, it's estimated there's another between half degree and full degree of warming in the system, because the Earth is not in radiative balance. That's why we're warming up. We are gaining more heat from solar radiation than we're exporting through the top of the atmosphere from infrared. And the reason, of course, is that infrared radiation is being intercepted by CO2, methane, ozone, the fluorocarbons, and so forth. And part of it is re-radiated. And it's out of balance, believe it or not, by about just a little less than a watt per square meter right now. But in the sort of mid-range scenario, we are out of balance by about 2 to 3 watts per square meter, which is going to cause all this problem. So we're talking about, you know, so if you had a 60-watt bulb, you know, and shined it over a meter of the Earth, you'd have a big, big problem. We're talking about a 60th to 360th of a 60-watt bulb. That's the magnitude of our problem. The other thing to be made here, I'm glad you asked that question, is that on sea level rise, just because, you know, we sort of... some of you watch this program called Monk, you know, this detective that's sort of an obsessive guy, and he's hung up on even numbers. Well, we're hung up on 2100. But that doesn't mean that sea level is going to stop rising at 2100. So, you know, there was a debate here about how much we should invest and so forth. As long as the Earth is out of radiative balance, sea level is going to rise, and we have 70 meters of it. And so, you know, it is a long-term problem. Maybe I should stop. I have a feeling that I've worn out my welcome. So, thank you.